Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. And we're going to join you for the next 90 minutes or so and just try to figure out what's going on. And we'll talk a lot about appointments and picks and the like. And we welcome your thoughts. Panel at WAMC.org, if you would like to join us, panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love to have you be with us and share your comments. Please keep them short and to the point, and we'll get to as many as possible. This is going to sound, I know in this environment, we're going to use this word a lot. This will sound elitist. However, if you are just riffing of a moment of something on the air and we don't know what you're talking about, I just want you to think about, like, sometimes people say, yeah, but what about, and then, but I don't know what we were talking about at that minute in the subsequent 8 or 9 minutes that will have passed since the letter came in. So sometimes if you can, you know, give us a sense of, you know, on this pick, That's helpful. That can be helpful for us and sort of determining, because sometimes people yell at us for not reading their letters. We simply don't know what they're about. We sent them out to the lab. We've had them looked at, and they just we don't know. So that is my only comment on that regard. We want to get everything right and have you properly represented at your views on the show. Let me introduce everybody to you. We'll get started. I said the term, I just kept on screaming the name of Matt Gaetz last night, and I also used an expletive in the middle of it, so Matt blank Gaetz. And I'm going to try really, I can't do that this morning, but I've been doing it now for almost, you know, 18 hours. So I have to stop that.
So Mike Bowen's on alert.
Mike Bowen is on alert. I have my button here. I have never done that. I don't plan on doing that. But I will say that it's very casually come out of my mouth over the last several hours. Anna Markowitz is with us, an advance lead for the White House and former chief of staff for State Senator Michelle Hinchey and former assistant county executive for Pat Ryan. Good morning. How are you?
Hanging in there, trying to not be despondent.
Is it nice not to be out doing events after a very active campaign season?
Well, the last event that I did was the concession speech at Howard. So almost anything is an upgrade from that experience. So I'm resting. I'm reading the newspaper with disbelief every day, just like the rest of us.
Okay, so a lot of sobbing college students at Howard. Well,
sorry, there were adults in other places in the country that were nearly sobbing.
Absolutely. I just know the visuals from that looked just heartbreaking.
There was a wide array of ages all crying at that event.
The concession the day after at Howard University, which, believe it or not, it was a week and a day ago.
Time flies when you're having fun.
It sure does. Judy Patrick is with us, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association. Hi, Judy.
Hello. So I am going over to Schenectady today to help my former newspaper, the Daily Gazette, celebrate 130 years of being in business. So there you go. Local news continues.
Now, how long were you with that newspaper?
About 40 years.
All right. So you have a very large chunk of that history under your belt.
I do. And it's nice to see them still out there and still covering those school boards, town boards, village boards, sewer boards, local politics, local businesses. So go Gazette.
Always a great newspaper. Always a great resource in this region, and certainly something that we celebrate in that they have survived, and hopefully we'll have 140 more. We'll see. Mark Whitman is a Wall Street investment banker. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Joe. Your story made me think of a somewhat similar circumstance. My wife and I were at the Aaron Boone home run game in the playoffs against the Red Sox, the Yankees versus Red Sox. And we happened to be sitting in a section that was populated with both Yankees and Red Sox fans, which has actually made it more fun. In the few minutes following Aaron Boone's home run, both Yankees and Red Sox fans were doing exactly what you did with Matt Gaetz's name, which was Aaron blanking Boone.
Yeah.
you heard it about 100 times, and without looking at the person, you could tell whether or not they were a Yankees fan or a Red Sox fan based on their intonation.
And it, what was great about it is just out of context, I was texting people, many of whom are panelists on this show, just those three words. And it was they were lightning fast in their responses because it seemed like we were all equally just sort of gobsmacked. So let's get to it. We'll start in and we'll make perfect sense of it all, won't we? here's the deal. Yesterday, let me just set the stage here for a moment. That yesterday, while we were on the air, President-elect Trump flew from Mar-a-Lago in Florida to Washington, D.C. to meet with current President Joe Biden to discuss the peaceful transfer of power. They had a meeting that was expected to be somewhere between a half hour and an hour. It ended up being nearly 2 hours long. By all accounts, and there were only, I believe, four people in the room, Trump, Biden, and their chiefs of staff. But by all accounts, and according to both the president-elect and the current president, and his spokesperson, it was a very cordial meeting. It was a very lengthy meeting and actually policy and detail oriented. And that was the story that was coming out around noontime. The president-elect then, but prior to that, had spoken to GOP leaders as well, and then got on the plane and went back to Mar-a-Lago. Then we started. That's when the fun started, and we got the nominations. First of all, we had been talking about Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, for several days. That was reported over the weekend, I believe, first by CNN, and then other news organizations also confirmed it. And at that point, there was no official announcement, so some were wondering as to what that meant, because there were other official announcements that went out in regards to the other picks. So the president-elect put out a press release and said that Marco Rubio is my pick for Secretary of State. Then next up on the hit parade was Tulsi Gabbard for. Now, Tulsi Gabbard was a Democrat. She was from the state of Hawaii. And then switched parties and was a very outspoken praiser of the then former president, now president-elect. And Tulsi Gabbard is expected to become the Director of National Intelligence, DNI, is what it is known as, has been a longtime critic of foreign policy establishment, and now will serve as the Director of National Intelligence. Ms. Gabbard was a lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve who served in Iraq, has been a longtime critic of the foreign policy establishment. Her nomination, another sign that Mr. Trump intends to give top foreign policy jobs to supporters who are deeply skeptical of the effectiveness of U.S. military intervention. And then, as if right on time, in prime time, ready for the big event, was the announcement that Matt Gaetz, a bomb thrower, if there ever was one, a man who has been credited or discredited for almost single-handedly taking away the speakership of one Kevin McCarthy. Ask Kevin McCarthy about it. He has a lot to say on the subject. He is a Florida congressman, was, and he has been chosen to be attorney general. And this is an attack dog. It's hard to think of somebody, anyone else, as describing him as anything else, to preside over the Department of Justice. He is 42 years old. He is a Florida Republican. He was investigated by the Justice Department on suspicion of child sex trafficking. This year, after the government case was shuttered, the House Committee on Ethics opened its own inquiry into the matter, which effectively ended on Wednesday night after Mr. Gates resigned from his seat. Mr. Gates has been accused of showing photos of nude women to colleagues on the House floor and seeking a pardon from the previous Trump White House. He has denied each of those allegations. There were sex trafficking and having sex with a minor, as well as random drug charges that were a part of that initial investigation. Mr. Gates is an avowed enemy of virtually every top Republican not named Trump. He led the charge last year to oust one Republican leader, Speaker Kevin McCarthy, and this year openly celebrated the resignations of two others, Mitch McConnell, who announced he would be retiring as minority leader, and Ronna McDaniel, who stepped down as chairwoman of the Republican Party National Committee. We've now 86th McCarthy, McDaniel, McConnell, Mr. Gates exalted on the social media platform X in March. I'm not some Lord of the Flies nihilist, Gates insisted to the New York Times in January, just after he had relinquished his 5-day blockade of Mr. McCarthy's eventually successful quest to be speaker. But 9 months later, Mr. Gates helped push Mr. McCarthy out of the job for good. That it was in January of 2023. Even Mr. Gates's many detractors ruefully acknowledge the tactical acumen of Mr. Gates, a former high school debate champion and commercial litigation attorney. Shortly after being elected to the House in 2016, he successfully worked the levers of the steering committee, and in a rarity for a freshman, landed plum assignments on both the Armed Services and Judiciary Committees.
Where do you even start? I mean, the fact that you have someone who is currently under investigation for child sex trafficking leading the Department of Justice. I mean, it is just, it's like a farce. It's like, yeah. So there's that. Feeling great. And then Tulsi Gabbard, she is a favorite of Russia and is going to be in charge of intelligence. Like, Can we please look into this? Is this all legal?
Well, and then so the big question overlying all of this, I think, is two questions. One, I think in the brightest of interpretations is that some of these have been thrown out as red meat, so that some of the less outrageous nominations can go through the process. But then that brings up the question of what's the process? Are we going to have a traditional process of being confirmed, or is it going to be by recess appointment, in which case anybody that President-elect Trump wants can get into those positions? So then that brings that to the fore. So it is like setting it up as to, well, we're not talking about Hegseth anymore, are we? Which is what we were doing yesterday and the day before. Mark.
Yeah, actually, Joe, I think that you can bring a lot of sense to this. And I think you have to look at initially the first Trump administration, where Trump and his team were the dog that caught the car. They weren't ready. Pence and his group stepped in and provided a lot of the appointments who were eventually confirmed to the cabinet and similarly senior positions. There were some in the mega world that made their way in, and the two, sort of the Reagan camp, Pence camp, and the mega camp battled it out and each notched wins. But even within the mega camp, if you remember at the time, people said that Trump was a moderate within the mega movement. Well, this time, the full-on mega movement has got the reins. And this is very intentional. It's clear, as you say, that Trump is trying to sort of swarm the Senate, right? He's trying to send in so many appointments that are unfit. There are at least three on the docket now. That given Senate norms, even when they do reject these things, the Senate is a political body that tends to, quote unquote, compromise. So what do you do if the other side just keeps sending you unsuitable after unsuitable appointment? How many times do you say no, and does the bar move as a result of this? The other thing is, it's not an accident that for institutions like the State Department, where the president necessarily calls the shots, he's got the whip hand with respect to the State Department, Trump appointed Rubio. But with respect to departments that have their own institutional momentum, justice and defense, Trump appoints pure loyalists without regard to experience or qualifications. And if you remember last time, Trump, had particularly expressed his discontent with Jeff Sessions. I think he said Jeff Sessions was subject to Stockholm Syndrome, was his comment at one point. And he obviously, we know what he thinks of defense generals and what he wants from them. Do you want to take a pause?
No, I want you to keep going.
Oh, okay. So I don't think, if you look at how he's organized these appointments, in terms of the swarming effect, in terms of the asking for the recess appointments, and in terms of where he's put the sort of all-out loyalists, I don't think this is all a accident in any means. And, you know, frankly, for the Senate, by the way, the Senate deserves this. These people, this body was 10 votes away from, I mean this metaphorically, putting a stake in the heart of this man politically, this man being Trump. They could have ended it. I love the fact that Mitch McConnell is now lashed to the tree watching us all this happen in a body that he thought he once revered. Because they've got to make tough decisions, and they should learn their lesson, and America needs to learn this lesson. If you don't take care of this now, in other words, you start moving the bar and let some of these folks, unsuitable folks in, this will come back to bite the institution of the United States, institutions broadly in the United States, but it'll also come back to bite the Senate. You should have taken your medicine up front. When you had a chance to impeach the man, you didn't. The chickens are home to roost. You better deal with them now. And that's also a lesson for U.S. foreign policy on trade or on our military force that we ought to keep in the back of our mind as we deal with these, you know, super isolationists that are part of the mega movement.
So stop me if you've heard this one before, but it is that the many Republicans who are out there talking about these appointments are saying, look, here's a guy, President-elect Trump, he won. He won with a majority. He has a mandate. And this is the line, and he deserves to have the cabinet that he wants. This is what we voted for. Judy Patrick.
So the U.S. Constitution does give the Senate the advice and consent authority. So they need to exercise it. It's supposed to be, you know, different branches of government. They need to step up. We'll see whether or not this is a true test of the Senate, of whether or not the Senate as an institution will survive. I can only imagine that Matt Gaetz can get approved through a recess appointment. I mean, Donald Trump is flooding the zone with news. This is what he did during his entire presidency. There are so much news every day, we can't focus on anything correctly or sufficiently for the public to understand what's going on. And it's a classic move. And I think he's positioning, maybe I'll get the Rubio does seem normal, right? I mean, Rubio of 2016 is a different guy than the Rubio of 2024.
Right.
So so if you throw out the Gaetzes, I mean, he could be a recess appointment. He'll only be there for 2 years, but that's all Trump needs. Also, keep in mind that all these people are going to be gone. Nobody's going to stay long, especially if you're trying to get in the limelight. I don't think Elon Musk is long for the Trump administration. He's getting too much attention, and Trump hates that. All these people look good on TV. I tend to think of the presidential appointments as puppets of the president. I agree with Mark about Secretary of State. That is something different. But I was prepared not to get hysterical over every single appointment. But Matt Gaetz is absurd. We will see. It's a true test of the Senate. They're a bunch of old white men, though. We'll see what they do.
You know, institutions that work well constrain even the actors within that institution. And Donald Trump is president because people restrained him during his first administration. And the most stark example of that is when he wasn't allowed to drive the beast up to the Capitol on January 6th and personally get physically involved in the altercation. Somebody in the Secret Service, who technically isn't his boss, he's the president, said, no, there are institutional constraints here. This is a bad Shakespearean tragedy. It's going to end badly. The question is, how much carnage do we have to see before it ends? And the Senate has a chance to at least constrain it, constrain the damage that we see before we get to the fifth act. And I hope they do what they ought. It's going to be gruesome to watch.
But you are hearing loyalists and people who have already been chosen for key cabinet positions say things like, Matt Gaetz is the most qualified person ever for the office of Attorney General. And I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying that I think it's going to take a while for that body as a whole to come around to a point where they are not saying, oh, that seems unfortunate.
Yeah, I think that they are going to appoint a lot of these people. I wish I didn't think that, but, you know, I think people fall in line and they do what they're supposed to do when, you know, and I think that they see it as this is the movement. This is the time. I wish it wasn't what I thought.
I mean, you have Lisa Murkowski, you have Susan Collins, and remember when we go back to counting on their votes, and who have both come out and said that they didn't think that this was appropriate. You have the possibility of Mitch McConnell not going for it, but then so there's your three.
Well, you've got Kat Cassidy, who also voted to impeach Trump, is still there, and then you've got Tillis, who's, you know, given the nature of his state, is probably more likely to behave than some others.
And then you have J.D. Vance, who's going to, you know, cast the deciding vote in the Senate for the confirmation. Mm-hmm. So I don't know necessarily if the numbers. Now, the other thing I want to talk about, we're going to take a break, but the other thing that I find really interesting about this is, here again, Matt Gaetz, a member of Congress who
former.
Has been taken
former gone.
Well, right, but gone. But, you know, we're still playing with the majority. It's razor thin. And not that I think that seat is going to go Democratic, but I think it will be interesting to see what the makeup of the Congress is, because this is still, they're playing with a very, very slim margin in both houses.
I had heard last night that Elon Musk and his crew were putting pressure on DeSantis to line up
Laura Trump
in this for the Senate seat should Rubio ultimately be appointed to. I mean, the machinations here are mind-numbing.
And apparently that's been going on, that from the reporting I've read, that has been going on since Rubio was passed over for vice president. So that's been something that's been in the works for a little while. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversations. We do welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be back right after this.
And the ragged rain, just a whisper away from a hurricane, and the heavy eyes of yesterday.
Every once in a while, you have to put a sugar pill into the arsenic. So Alec Jones's media empire, InfoWars, has been sold at auction. The winner? The Onion. No joke. The satirical news outlet bought InfoWars' parent company, Free Speech Systems, backed by a group of Connecticut families. Jones said on today's show that security had notified him he needs to vacate the premises immediately. I didn't know he was still with the premises, I'll be honest with you. I thought that had already taken care of itself, so that shows where I'm at. Proceeds of the sale will go to paying down Jones's $1.5 billion debt to families of Sandy Hook victims who won two defamation suits against him for spreading false conspiracy. Jones accused the families of being actors, faking the killing of 20 children and six educators in an effort to drum up support for gun control. And Jones supporters who believe the lies threatened and harassed the families for years, theories that the 2012 elementary school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, never happened. The Connecticut families agreed to forego a portion of their recovery to increase the overall value of the Onion's bid, enabling its success, according to their lawyers. Our clients knew that true accountability meant an end to InfoWars and an end to Jones's ability to spread lies, pain, and fear at scale, said Chris Mattai, attorney for the Connecticut plaintiffs. The sale, which still needs to be approved by a bankruptcy court, includes Jones's studio equipment, his lucrative online nutritional supplement store.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, right, but... And domain names, a customer list, and some of Jones's social media accounts through, though not his ex account. And not surprisingly, Jones responded to all of this angrily on his show, which I think is sort of how he responds to everything on his show. But so there is that story out there this morning that I'm sure you will be hearing.
I can't wait to see what cabinet he's appointed to.
Yeah. I mean, you do want. I mean, I know you're making. I know you're making a joke. I think, but you do wonder about things about White House spokesperson communications. I mean, these are all positions too that will be interesting to see.
Right. Tomorrow, you will have a whole nother slate of people to talk about.
I keep on thinking of this really horrible joke that I found to be incredibly funny years ago, but John Stewart said in the beginning days after Trump was John Oliver said in the beginning days of the 2016 after the 2016 Trump win, said that every day there's a different flurry and every day there's something that is more alarming and scarier than the other, that actually when you look down your phone and you see that Mary Tyler Moore has died, you're relieved. And you know, it's sort of like, yeah, we're feeling that again.
Like, yeah, it's only been like a week.
Feels like that again. All right, let's go to Denise, who says, this is more like the junk drawer than the cabinet. I like that. See what she did there?
That's good.
And the only way to gain power is through retribution, and fear, and Trump knows this very well. We also go to Diane. Why is anyone surprised? We all heard what was going to be done. The only light is John Thune along with some other Republican senators, i.e. Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, plus probably a few others who will vote against this ridiculous appointment. I pray that the no votes will continue. Well, we shall see.
Well, John Thune got appointed by a secret ballot. Let's see what happens when they have to actually vote out in public.
Right. It was the Trump choice was Rick Scott. And was then, but John Thune, I think, was always, I mean, here's a guy who, I know this is quaint, but was actually in line for this position and was expected under whatever normal circumstances are or were to be the next Senate majority leader.
By the way, the letter writer, I think correctly highlights a point, which is there was this discussion amongst Trump supporters as to whether or not we were to believe the extreme statements he said. Is this really going to be the revenge tour? Is he really going to be their retribution? And you know, a lot of us were seen as bedwetters and pearl clutchers for warning that we ought to believe him. I think now there's no question as to how serious he was, frankly.
And I think this is when you need an active, vigilant press. I think when things start happening, when people's income tax returns start getting audited, if they happen to be on MSNBC a lot, we need to write those stories. We need to let the light shine on what is happening if things happen like this. I mean, but once again, there's going to be so much coming down the pike that it's going to be hard to keep on top of everything.
I also think the press ought to emphasize on behalf of the Senate or for the Senate's benefit the fact that if you let an administration populate these positions with loyalists, particularly loyalists who are unqualified and unsuited for these positions, this will come back and the Senate will have to wear it, whether it be Watergate, Iran-Contra. I can think of other instances. But, you know, this the Senate, if they want to sort of take the path of least resistance, it is to nip this in the bud now. And if they don't, they'll be wearing it down the line. So Trump's wrath in the short term is one thing. But what will happen if he's allowed to proceed without guardrails is another. And it's more costly for all of us, even the Senate itself.
But think about all the senators who also imagine themselves as president or running for president in 2028, and that has got to be part of this calculus as well, because there's nobody more likely to want to be president than a senator.
Yeah, but imagine a senator who approves this nomination and a couple others, and they end up wearing it. They're not that's got to be more damning to their political career than standing up now, frankly. I don't know when the "Do you have no decency, sir?" moment comes. Maybe it never does. Maybe we just have to crash the plane first, and then you've got to hope that we crash the plane over an area that doesn't have a lot of civilians in it, frankly.
But every one of these, I shouldn't say this, not everyone, but a lot of them have gone and found tape from, you know, years and years and years ago, like 2022, where the person is deriding Trump and saying this is awful and this is bad and this, I mean, J.D. Vance, for goodness sakes. Yeah. And then the turn, you know, and then the turn, and then they become the ultimate loyalist. So I don't know if that if that doesn't cause the shame moment, I don't know what is going to down the line. I mean, you've already said, well, my feelings have changed. I don't know. Where do you go from there?
I think you're sitting in the Senate and, you're in the Justice Department thinking about voting up or down on Gates's nomination. And you don't think that if you nominate him that, you know, a year from now you're going to be dealing with something more severe, you're fooling yourself.
I agree, but will they be held accountable for it?
I don't think they will. And I think that Trump did so many things that should have held him accountable, and none of it did. And so I think that people, I don't know if they're correct in their assumption, I think that they think that they're immune to the kind of retaliation or negative press that would have happened before. And there's going to be such a drowning of negative press that people won't even remember this.
I hope you're right, Mark, and I certainly understand your point, and it's well taken. I just wonder, when you have somebody like Matt Gaetz who single-handedly, not really, but almost single-handedly torpedoed the speakership of Kevin McCarthy, was roundly hated by most Republican congressional leaders, congressmen and senators on the GOP, and then turns out to be the top pick for AG with what appears to be so far a lot of key support. I don't know. I mean, it just seems like now would be the time that you would say, oh, yeah, maybe we were right about him. But let's take a break. We'll let that hang there in the air for a moment. I think there's going to be a lot hanging in the air over the next mini shows. Oh, that's right. We went through. Did we take a break before? Oh, we took it late? I don't even remember taking the break. Yeah. Oh, all right. Was it a good break?
Joe,
it was a good break? All right. Was it catered? I don't remember it. Wow. Isn't that nice?
On the Matt Gaetz issue, it's worth pointing out that it's been reported and I think stated by a representative that the Ethics Committee report on his alleged misdeeds was due out on Friday, which one could assume is why he resigned last night, even though I don't believe he had to. He could have gone through the confirmation process and returned to the House had he not been successful. So he's basically done his math and figured out that he's better squashing that report and taking the risk that he doesn't ultimately end up as Attorney General.
But also it tells me that, you say risk, but it also tells me that they're willing to fight for this because otherwise he's out of a job. Like it's all or nothing at this point. He's not going to go back to the Congress. He would then be out if it, meaning that it would be more of a reason to do the recess appointment.
Yeah, I don't know. And then there's, of course, another issue that they could slot him in somewhere which doesn't require confirmation if he doesn't eventually become AG. So I don't, you know, say he's out of a job. I don't think it's that bad for him. But I take your point.
So here's another point that I think is a good one. This one from Benton, who writes to us and says, Trump has total immunity. He's the most powerful that he's ever been. Do you think that Republicans will ever stand against him? That is a good point.
Yeah.
Well, it's not total immunity. I mean, the Supreme Court has ruled that he has immunity for tasks performed in the execution of his job as president. So perhaps if he did something criminal, like shot somebody, maybe he could defend it somehow. But, I mean, it's not total. It's pretty close, pretty darn close to total.
Pretty total. I don't know.
No, I think, Judy, I take your point. We know that the Supreme Court took their eraser and started rubbing against the Constitution, and they tore a hole in it. We don't know how big the hole is because it's not defined, even with respect to the four cases at least three of the cases outstanding against Trump, leaving Georgia aside. The courts were still trying to decide what the immunity ruling meant, both to his potential responsibility as also admissibility of evidence that was gained while he was serving in the presidential capacity. So, yeah, it's not total immunity, but if you listen to, I think it was Elena Kagan? No, it was Sotomayor's dissent as to what she thought it might mean for the president. It looks like it's a pretty broad window through which you can drive a lot of potentially illegal, what was previously illegal activity. And I do think this whole issue raises the importance of the Supreme Court and the fact that we don't expect, given how it's behaved with respect to that decision and how the two justices who have either flown standards of opposition outside of their places of residence or whose wife has been involved in the resistance, it's not clear that the Supreme Court's going to provide an effective check against this president on a consistent basis either.
I mean, I don't mean to be overly negative here, but we had an insurrection, and like we're not gonna see any payoff from that as far as any legal consequence as a result, and if we do. And anything going further, I'm going to go out and make a bold assumption that none of us will be alive to see it.
I think the true test of this would be on day one. Who gets pardoned from the January 6th riots? Who is he going to do a blanket pardon for anyone who was arrested that day? There may very well be some blowback if he starts pardoning people who attacked police officers. I think if you listen to them carefully, maybe he will stop short of that. Again, we will find out on January 21st.
Yes. So, Mark, you furrowed your brow, which I found to be disconcerting.
No, first of all, on the pardons, I think it's, you know, it's worse than just no legal responsibility. I mean, he's going to turbocharge and virtue signal to the white Christian nationalists. No matter where that pardon line stands, they're going to feel emboldened. It's just a matter of how emboldened they feel after that pardon comes out. And that's going to have real-world implications. And there are many of those people who said, well, I showed up because the president wanted us to show up and asked us to show up, and he's the president. And if you don't think that, you know, some of those people, you know, when they're in disputes on the street— are going to say, well, you know, this is the America that I believe in, and it doesn't have room for others. I mean, you're going to hear that excuse for illegal behavior in the future. I predict it now in the wake of those pardons. So I don't think it's a neutral that there was no repercussions for January 6th. I think it's going to turbocharge a lot of the white Christian nationalists. And again, I just wonder, you know, I know there's no backseas on the general election, but you know, if you go back to the folks who said, well, Trump, this isn't really the retribution tour, I wonder what those folks think now. And I've thought a lot about this. Don't get me wrong. I'm okay. You know, we had a process, an election, and I'm not going to violently try and overthrow the results. But that's different than saying, on a collective basis, I won't hold ethically and morally responsible those who decided to prioritize their perceived economic interests over the interests of this country. I mean, it's sort of turbocharging white Christian nationalists in this country is going to have a profound cost, and there are many in this country who are responsible for it. And I'm also perfectly fine, given the history of this country, whether it be during slavery or while people were talking about the America First movement, I'm fine being in the minority and saying I'm right. I have no reservations about that point. Now, that doesn't mean I get to abuse any individual or mistreat them or even misspeak, but that's different than saying I don't understand where this country broke, who we should properly hold responsible for voting Trump in, and what the serious implications of that are likely to be. This is a Shakespearean tragedy. It is just a matter of how far the carnage goes before the final curtain comes down.
I don't know if people are regretting their decision yet. I think that we underestimated greatly how upset people were with the status quo in this country. And people would rather tear it all down and hope that they end up a little bit further to the top when it gets rebuilt than stick with what we have. And I think that as Democrats, we need to reckon with that, and we need to really take seriously that we need to reform a lot of these systems. I personally am not a tear it down kind of gal, but you know, I think that we need to think critically about how we're going to respond to all this. And I don't know if people do regret it yet.
We get this letter from David, and David says, when was the last time any politician was seriously held accountable for anything? The entire political class is a sham. They write their own rules, they pass their own laws, and grant themselves immunity. And Trump has taken the Apprentice show on the road, and we are now living with the results. We must fasten our seatbelts, writes David.
Yeah, the only thing is, I'd say George Santos and Robert Menendez probably feel like they've, I mean, it happens. I don't think it works with respect to the office of the presidency currently.
Point taken though. But I do understand the tenor of the letter of that it is really difficult to be held accountable for something, and I mean.
Right, George Santos was pretty egregious.
Well, George Santos was pretty egregious, but it also took a really long time for them to move George Santos out of that seat too, which I think is important to note. Let's take it. I didn't already take this break, right, Mike? This is actually a break I need to take. Okay, good. very engaged as your host this morning. we'll take a break. I'll remind you that you can be a part of the program, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We're going to go over to Ray Graff and get some news, and then we'll come back and do more show right after this.
Louisiana had held back with an easy sway. Your river hills welcome in all the words I was scared to say. So it's good.
President-elect Donald Trump and current President Joe Biden met yesterday, just after 11 a.m., their first extended meeting since the debate performance that drove Biden out of the race earlier in the year. For Trump, it marked a triumphant return to an office where he sat for 4 years. A week after decisively winning an election by relentlessly attacking Biden's mental capacity and then by casting the Biden administration as a disaster. Congratulations, Biden said at the start of the meeting during the brief time reporters were in the room. He added that he hoped it would be a smooth transition. Politics is tough, Trump responded, and in many cases, it's not a nice world, but it is a nice world today. The meeting stretched for nearly 2 hours, longer than the one Trump had 8 years ago with President Barack Obama. During a portion, they were joined by White House Chief of Staff Jeff Zients and his incoming counterpart, Susie Wiles. The White House press secretary called it a substantive meeting, an exchange of views. She said that she has spoken with Biden after the meeting ended and that he wanted to emphasize that Trump was gracious and that he came to the meeting with a detailed list of questions. She declined to provide any details about what was on Trump's list of questions and what advice Biden had offered or whether Trump's refusal to acknowledge Biden's 2020 win had come up. I don't think I would have brought that up in conversation.
You know, Joe, I was glad to heartened to hear that the meeting went 2 hours. By the way, both those guys should get acting awards for the show they put on for the cameras in front of that roaring fire, by the way. That thing was really going. The world is fraught with dangerous spots. In Ukraine, you know, if you're the Russians, you've got an incredible incentive to try and grab more land before Trump comes in. And I guess he's said he's going to solve this in one day before he's even president. So if you're Russia, you're in a hurry, which I think is dangerous. If you're Israel, you have a pretty keen incentive, again, to worry whether or not Trump is going to encourage you to reach a peace agreement or at least a ceasefire. And before that happens, there's probably an incentive to take more military action. There's also the risk that that in the intervening period, Israel pokes Iran, which is also potentially dangerous. So there are spots around the world where the U.S. policy would benefit from a clear message from both the outgoing and the incoming administration. And no matter how much they may not care for each other, it's in the interest of America and the interest of those individuals to speak with a unified voice, either publicly or behind the scenes with these actors. And I hope that's what they were doing yesterday, is setting that up.
You know, you have a meeting like this with the intention to accomplish things. And so the question is, what was Biden trying to accomplish and what was Trump trying to accomplish? I do not think Trump came up with a list of questions. I think that was Susie Wiles. Maybe these are practical issues that they want to resolve. But the fact that it went 90 minutes to 2 hours means that it was far more than, well, when exactly do I get to move in and can I leave these same drapes up? I think this was a substantial discussion. And I would love to find out what kind of message Biden was trying to send to Trump about what he is important to leave in place. You know, we see that all the executive orders that Trump did, Biden undid, and then now all the executive orders that Biden has issued, Trump will undo. It's like ruling the country by executive order is not something I'd love to see as a citizen going forward.
Maybe we'll learn more when we get to read the letter that the former president leaves the incoming president. We'll find out a little bit more as Biden pens that missive.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have high hopes for collaborative messaging on a lot of these issues. Maybe that's what they were working on. I think that given the landslide that the Republicans won by, I think it's kind of given Democrats a pause to say, hey, well, we better like really take this transfer of power seriously and be thoughtful about it and take into account how the American people are feeling. And I think that that's kind of why this meeting lasted longer, but I don't know if anything will actually come out of it.
Can I want to take polite issue with something you said, if I
sure.
may. And I know you're emotionally invested in the outcome. But and by the way, I think that electoral map is a horrible graphic representation of what happened. Because Trump won 50.3 or 50.5% of the vote. This wasn't a landslide. As a matter of fact,
so many of those votes are in California and New York, where
but 170. This is a flawed way to look at it, yeah. But it is a way we look at it. So just for context, 175,000 votes in three states would have flipped the Electoral College. Last time it was 40,000. So when we say landslide, the reason that map is so bad is because every state that you win by one vote, which by the way, the Republicans tend to win the larger geographic states, mm-hmm. with the exception of California. It turns red and it looks dim, but if you look at the incumbency penalty around the world, it's about 3%, 3-4%, and the Democrats did better than that. Now, frankly, they should have prevailed, and that's a different day's discussion. But I think, in terms of context, yes, the Republicans won, and they've won most likely, if not already, all three chambers. But it was not. Yeah. This was not a landslide. This was not a drubbing.
They won by a lot more than they did in 2016. In 2016, Hillary won the popular vote, and this time we lost the popular vote. And I think that and with all we know, you know, I think it really, I was personally surprised by that.
But that swing was about 4% of the electorate. So not even the populace, but the electorate. That is not a landslide. This is not. Go back to when Ronald Reagan won every state to save Minnesota and Maine, or go back to FDR. Those were landslides. This was not a landslide. This was a convincing victory, but not a landslide. And I just think contextually, the Democrats actually, if you think about the fact of where the wasted votes are, the Democrats should take some comfort from this election, that they're a lot closer to in a way, they're mathematically a lot closer to turning the Electoral College than they've ever been. Now, the big issue for the Democrats in my mind is historically there was this insistence that because of the makeup of the Democratic coalition, including the racial makeup, there was this assumption that demographics would hand them governance into the indefinite future at some point. With the loss of some of the strongholds, mm-hmm. where they didn't, actually, I shouldn't say the loss, with the diminishment of their margin within some ethnic groups in the mm-hmm. United States, that assumption is gone. So that means in order to prevail, it's got to be a policy answer, and the Democrats have to change their policies. But when they start thinking about how to do that, they ought not to think about the fact that it was a landslide. They ought to think about the need to do, they need to sort of adjust what they're doing, not a wholesale change in what they're doing.
Look at Mr. Hopeful. Destiny is calling me. Open up my eager eyes because I'm Mr. Brightside. Very nice. But it does seem like no matter how we look at it, the numbers are the numbers, and it was still a big win, and I do think that will be the way we remember it. For a long time to come.
Again, I just think you have to be careful. Don't look at the electoral map. Go look at the numbers state by state. And again, there is this fallacy. I call it the sniper fallacy. That, you know, the 175,000 votes.
Maybe, like maybe change the name. Maybe workshop that.
Yeah. Well, I'm
Mr. Brightside.
I'm open to change it. There's this thing about last time it was 40,000 votes and this was 175,000 votes, and you know that. Politics is about carpet bombing. It's not about being a sniper, right? I mean, the message you put out goes to the whole population. So it's not as easy as adjusting that few people. But the Democrats lost, and they should have won. But again, it wasn't a drubbing.
Well, but I think it was also the Senate. It was also the House. I think it was not just like, oh, our one candidate for president didn't win. It was a full-on flip of all of the institutions. And we thought that the House was going to be run by Democrats. So, you know, it was a lot of things that we thought were going to happen didn't happen.
Well, I don't know why anybody thought that the party that wins the presidency— and the popular vote wins the House, period. I mean, so I don't know why people thought that was going to
flip. I didn't think that he would win the popular vote.
Oh, okay.
You know, the terms jargon and, you know, landslide are, they're jargon. It's jargon. It's used to rationalize whatever will happen in an administration. And it's something the political press uses too much. It's something politicians tend to grab onto because it gives them the justification to do whatever they want. But you can slice it and dice it any way you want. Trump was elected president,
yeah,
and the Democrats really need to take a hard look at their messaging and reestablishing trust with the people that they need to win support for the agenda they want to pursue.
Well, I think they need to look at their agenda, too. And towards that end, I mean, one of the first people out of the gate criticizing the conventional Democrats was Bernie Sanders. But just I'd like to highlight the fact that Harris did better in Vermont than Sanders did. So he ought to take a seat, frankly. I mean, I think it's worth listening to him with respect to sort of becoming economically more centrist with respect to the Democrats, but perhaps maybe not so much on the culture war side of it. Do we need to listen to the Bernie Sanders of the world? I think that's always – it's a danger that the first critical voice out of the box is often the extreme wing of the party, and maybe they're so quick because they realize they might be the ones who need to quiet down a bit in the long run.
Well, Andy Beshear from Kentucky issued an from Kentucky, nice op-ed about the need of Democrats to start listening more. That seems like a reasonable, moderate voice or message to get out there in this transition period. You know, one of the things that's happening is we're so focused on these, you know, wild, stunning announcements of appointments, so we're not really paying attention to the other mechanics of what's happening in this transition because, trust me, a lot more levers are being pulled than just naming Gates as Attorney General and Rubio as Secretary of State. So, we need to watch everything that's happening, and there is so much because the bureaucracy of the federal government is so immense and the politics are so extraordinarily powerful that everybody needs to be paying attention to everything. And don't the shiny object now are these appointments, whether or not they get through, but there's a lot more going on, and we need to be cognizant of that.
Absolutely, and much more to come. I mean, that's the thing so much more to come.
The appointments tend to come right out like at 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I think he's trying to hit the late afternoon news cycle.
Sure.
Very smart.
It's working. It's working. All right, let's go to some other stuff that we want to discuss this morning. We do welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Mika says... Or Micah, I believe it's Micah, to panelists who say the Democrats need to ... No, we Americans need to address what's happening to our country. The causes of why we and where we are now is more profound than normal politics. It's about who we are as a country, as members of humanity. Then we go to this letter. James says, let's be honest about what's happening here. Forgive the DC Comics reference, but Trump is literally assembling his Legion of Doom. If there was ever a time when we needed a Superman, Batman, or a Wonder Woman, the time is now. Or how about a Star Wars comparison? Trump is Darth Vader. The MAGA movement is clearly the evil empire, and we here at WAMC are part of the rebel resistance. We need someone new. We need a Luke Skywalker. But will the Democrats be able to find one by 2028? And that is the question.
I sure hope so. I don't know who that person is. Pete Buttigieg? I like him. We'll see.
I think they better find spokespeople before 28. I mean, I think, you know, I haven't heard from Schumer yet on these appointments. Maybe, you know, he's never really been the right person to be sort of the leader. But I do think you need leadership within the Democrats, and in all deference, I don't think in the short or intermediate term, the Walls or Harris are going to continue in that role, frankly.
Look, Mark nails it, says Kevin. Many of us are beyond heartbroken. We are brain broken. We just can't make sense of any of it. We go to other stories, and we...
Did that letter say I was brain broken?
did what?
Did that letter say I was brain broken?
No, I think that you nailed it, that we are, that there's just so much happening that... That was my interpretation of it.
We're all brain broken.
Yes, yes. I think it was indeed meant as and a was
compliment.
A
compliment,
yes. Okay, so Trump aides are exploring plans to boost Elon Musk's effort by wresting control from Congress. This in the subject heading of... This government spending commission. So President-elect Trump's aides are readying unconventional strategies to implement at least some recommendations from a new government spending commission with or without congressional approval. On Tuesday, Trump announced that tech billionaire Elon Musk and former GOP presidential hopeful Vivek Ramaswamy would jointly lead a Department of Government Efficiency that would produce DOGE, which would produce recommendations on overhauling U.S. agencies, an effort that people in Musk's orbit said would aim to apply slash-and-burn business ideologies to U.S. government. The commission will officially operate outside the administration, what will work with the White House Budget Office, according to the president. Although changes to government spending typically requires an act of Congress, Trump's aides are exploring plans to challenge a 1974 budget law in a way that would give the White House the power to unilaterally adopt the Musk Commission's proposals, one of the people said. It is unclear if Trump will ask Congress to approve changes to the budget law or first appeal to the courts to do so. Though aides have previously endorsed either approach, Ramaswamy, a former pharmaceutical executive who has said he would, quote, stop funding agencies that waste money and don't operate on meritocratic principles. I said that wrong, didn't I?
We get the gist.
Meritocratic.
Thank you very much, Mark. Has publicly called on Congress to repeal the law and has suggested workarounds if it is not repealed. Okay, so I want to talk about the subject at hand. I also just want to, just a quick shout out, because in that article they refer to this 1974 law that they're looking to change. And I think a lot of people, as these appointments come out and as things change, like, well, we didn't know we were in for this. Like, we didn't know what Trump, you know, wasn't saying. So I clicked on the link of that law, and there's a whole article in the Washington Post about exactly what Trump was looking to do in regards to this law that was dated on June 7th. The press did a really good job in explaining exactly what they were looking to do. The only thing not included in that article from June was Elon Musk, but everything else,
he's going to do a really good job
was,
of this.
Was key on, and I just think that is important to realize that a lot of this stuff that we're looking at, going, oh, we had no idea it was going to do that. All that stuff has been out there for a really, really, really long time. Mark.
Well, none of this, I've stopped being surprised. Matter of fact, I think we should all fill out a bingo card and guess where Marjorie Taylor Greene is going to end up being nominated for. But so we're not surprised when that happens. But I'm not surprised.
My vote's FEMA.
Yeah, I thought NASA. But
okay.
I don't remember this particular issue being covered, although I know I read at least one of the reports regarding it. But it's clear, I mean, Trump's going to try and push, and Trump and more importantly the mega folk behind him are going to try and push all these boundaries everywhere they can. And the risk is accentuated by the fact that he did a good job of appointing judges throughout the federal judiciary and that he's got undue sway with the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is now unduly political, as we know. So, I mean, this is just one of the risks. I think it's broadly one of the risks we knew we were going to run, and specifically this seems like a soft point that they're going to probe in terms of a potential restriction on the executive that they're trying to remove.
I mean, I think that Project 2025 laid this out pretty clearly, that they were going to attack civil service, that they were going to try to get rid of departments that they don't believe in, like the EPA. I think that that is what this DOGE department is going to do. And I think that Musk has a track record of doing this at X, at, you know, being kind of ruthless in all of his businesses that he runs. I mean, I think he, for better or worse, is a highly efficient person.
Other people have said this, but having two people lead a commission on efficiency is not efficient. I think that they will come up with into more roadblocks than they are thinking. I never thought that cutting government waste was a big issue for Trump. It wasn't something that came across to me as I listened to his stump speeches. So I don't think he cares that much about it. But he does need to find some money to maybe offset the tax cuts he's going to bring. But there's not enough there. There's so much that's baked into that federal budget that he's not going to be able to touch. And again, you know, I've covered so many commissions in my life. I know that they issue a report, and one or two or three or four or five things will get enacted, but it's just a cover to do a couple of major things that he's got in his head that he wants done.
I think it's a guise. Like, I think he's saying, oh, it's government waste, and that's something that resonates with a lot of people. A lot of people think that there is extreme...
But we're talking about the education department,
yeah,
among other things.
I think this is a way to gut things that... that he doesn't support and to get
rid
of.
This isn't like Nancy's stapler. This is the...
Can we talk specifically about the education department? I love this one. So what does the education department do? What does it spend its money on? It administers student loans. It administers the federal funds that go out to students, or I'm sorry, to schools around the country. And it keeps statistics on student performance and related items. The one thing the education department doesn't do directly is educate anyone. So the fallacy is that you could dissolve the department, but all those functions are still going to be performed somewhere else in the government. Maybe you save money, maybe you don't. But this big hurrah, like, I'm going to get rid of the department, fine. You can strip down the sign above the building, I suppose, and reassign the people within it to other departments that are going to do something. But you're still going to perform all those functions, and you're not going to do it all that less expensively one way or the other.
We'll pause you there. We'll take a break. We'll come back and wrap up on the other side of news from the BBC.
You got no one left to hold you, no one left to hold. Sing, ooh, babe.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday, the 14th of November. I'm Joe Donahue. We have Judy Patrick, Anna Markowitz, and Mark Whitman with us making up the panel this morning. We couldn't be happier, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. And when I say we couldn't be happier, we couldn't be happier that we have this set of panelists talking about what we're, you know, not necessarily what we're talking about, but that we have them to discuss the issues at large. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Seems like we're just going to be spending a lot of time in the future of over-explaining things. What I really mean is, I want to talk a little bit about some of the, I'll admit, it's hard to find like other news that is not as what's the word I'm looking for that isn't as
devastating,
gloomy.
Well, I was going to say the word I was going with, which isn't the word, but influential, but is important in how this country is going to run. And but yes, Mark, you raised your hand very politely, I would add.
Before we move on, I just wanted to say about Elon Musk that the interesting thing I've read many times is that, you know, Musk is reported to, he's going to save, is it $2 trillion? And if you, and what people do is they say, well, it's not going to be entitlement, so take that part of the budget off. And it's not going to be defense, so take that part of the budget off. But I think that they're going a little too quickly there.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the functions that Elon Musk performs with SpaceX and with Starlink, if I got the name right, he's got things that are sort of near defense-ish. And I would not be at all surprised to have him put his hand up and say, you know, you don't need to, and this is one example, you know, you don't need to have your own independent satellite system to run the nuclear defenses of this country. The private sector could do that so much less expensively. So that's why his appointment is a little bit fraught. I don't mind. You could, look, set intelligent business people loose all they want to hand in their reports as to where they want to, where they think they may be able to cut in the government. I mean, if you look at it, Bloomberg's management of New York City did not revolutionize New York City, but it did offer some meaningful improvements that came as a result of his background as a business person. So there might be ground to gain there. The problem is you got to be very careful about self-interest and self-dealing. And I think it's particularly fraught with Musk because he owns X, which doesn't have a lot of value to it, but has a real business. And Donald Trump owns a huge portion of Truth Social, which doesn't have much of a business to it, but has a huge valuation. And one can only think of the combinations there that would be fraught with conflict of interest between the two of them.
Meanwhile, elsewhere in Washington, Special Counsel Jack Smith plans to resign and wrap up his federal prosecutions of Donald Trump before the president-elect takes office and can fire him. That, according to a person familiar with Smith's plans, this from the Washington Post. The Post reported last week that Trump's election victory had prompted the special counsel to start winding down the prosecutions instead of continuing court proceedings until Inauguration Day. Ending the two federal cases could allow Smith to deliver a final report detailing his findings to Attorney General Merrick Garland before Trump becomes the 47th president of the United States. Garland appointed Smith to oversee the investigation 2 years ago, and the special counsel secured the historic indictments months later. One accuses Trump of hoarding highly classified documents after leaving the White House and obstructing a government effort to retrieve them. The other charges him with trying to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. But Trump's re-election last week means the end of both federal cases against him because Justice Department policy prohibits prosecuting a sitting president. Smith appears to still be weighing how to handle an ongoing appeal in Trump's classified documents case. He has asked the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit to overturn Judge Aileen Cannon's decision that Smith was unlawfully appointed and the case should be dismissed. One possible option, according to legal experts, is to remove Trump as a co-defendant from the case as the appeal continues while keeping his co-defendants, Walt Nauta, a longtime valet and aide, and Carlos de Oliveira, the property manager at Trump's Mar-a-Lago Club and Resort. Prosecutors want to overturn Cannon's ruling not only to resurrect the classified documents case, but also to protect Justice Department appointments during the Trump administration and beyond.
Well, I think it's really important for them to clarify that principle that Cannon knocked down, the fact that the special prosecutor didn't have the authority to step into this case. For going forward, I'd like a resolution of that because that's unclear. I mean, whatever happens, Matt Gaetz is going to dismiss any other cases against the underlings, too. I mean, you could make a case for it, but it's going to go nowhere. So what's the most practical thing to happen? What does the public need to know? I mean, again, going back in time, it would have been nice if Jack Smith had been appointed a little sooner so we wouldn't have the last 2 years to try to scramble to have these cases resolved before the election. But that's water under the bridge. I'm just thinking that maybe Jack Smith could write a book, and then maybe 2 or 3 years from now we would really know what happened.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a little too late, and it would have been, yeah, great if we could have had these results before the election, but now how will it impact anything? I mean, he's still going to be the president no matter what the outcome of those are, right?
If you would have asked me a year or two ago, I would have gone on I probably did on this program, going to rant against Merrick Garland. But I am convinced no matter how quickly the Justice Department acted to take measures against Donald Trump legally, the Supreme Court has proven that it would have thwarted it and pushed any meaningful resolution well beyond this election. So I don't think Merrick Garland was particularly I don't think he moved with alacrity, but I don't think it's his responsibility. I think the Supreme Court always provided that backstop for Trump and clearly would have. I think it's smart that the Justice Department is trying to preserve the dispute over appointing special counsels, and they should prevail on that point. And I think it's regrettable that Trump and whomever the AG is will dismiss all of this. But we knew this was up for grabs in the election, and that's the way it's worked out. I think it emphasizes, back to my point earlier, you know, Mitch McConnell had that wood stake. Again, I'm metaphorically not – I don't mean to be violent, but he could have finally put the wood stake through Donald Trump's political heart. He had the ability, and he tried to slough off that responsibility to the judiciary, which was never going to act. And so this is back on the Senate. So you know what? If they have a lousy week trying to figure out what to do with Trump's appointments, good for them.
You know, and I understand why these prosecutions move forward against Trump. But in retrospect, what it has left us with are judicial decisions that further protected the president, almost gave him 100% immunity. And if that decision on the special prosecutor stands, it will have weakened the special prosecutor law. So at the end of the day, we are left in a weakened position when it comes to trying to control presidential power.
Yeah, not only that, we provided Trump with a tailwind, given the public's general response to the indictment. So if we were trying to further the cause of justice by pursuing Trump, we've talked about this before, it backfired.
Finally, New York Governor Kathy Hochul is expected to announce the revised congestion pricing program today. Seems like good timing. Kathy Hochul will announce a $9 toll with the aim of putting it in place before Donald Trump takes office. Is expected to announce this. This is a toll for most vehicles to enter Midtown and Lower Manhattan. According to people familiar with the matter, Governor Kathy Hochul intends to announce the state's revised program, which is lowering the initial $15 charge for cars to enter Manhattan's core at peak hours. The new plan would be fast-tracked for implementation. It would go before the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, otherwise known as the MTA, for approval next week and would most likely take effect before President-elect Donald Trump takes office in January, a time frame that aims to preempt Mr. Trump's his vows to kill the program.
Talk about being tone deaf. I'm sorry, but the Democrats instituting a $9 toll to get into New York City. I understand the overarching themes in trying to reduce congestion, trying to reduce environmental pollution. But all I hear and all of most people hear is the government is going to charge me another toll. One thing we hate more than the price of bread and the price of milk is our tolls. And I just, even upstate where we don't even go to New York City, the idea that people are going to have to pay $9 to drive on a city street, I'm just saying this is not a good political stand for anybody who wants to thrive in politics in New York State should take.
I think that's why they waited until after the election to do that. And I also think that they're using it to fill a funding gap in the MTA. And if they didn't do this, they would have had to raise the price of fares. And so do you want people who are more constrained on income, who are buying individual fares, to pay that? And I don't.
Yeah, look, the city streets don't just appear. They're paved by the government. I think Kathy Hochul's interjecting herself in this when it was all ready to go showed a lack of leadership and a inordinate deference to political whims. The fact that she's instituting it now at a lower number is a bit of a kick save on her part. I disagree wholly that it's I think it's a sensible measure, whether it be for the environment, whether it be for the livability of those in New York City or even, frankly, the health of people in New York City. I think this thing makes a lot of sense. I was sorry to see it delayed, and I'm happy to see it reinstated, and I hold Hochul responsible for the delay.
I think there are other ways they could have reduced congestion in the city. My visit to Athens, they restrict who can go into the city by their license plate, odd days and even days. There are different ways of handling congestion rather than just charging people to enter the city.
May I just quickly say, too, that last Friday the train service was cut fairly dramatically from in the Empire Corridor from Albany to New York City because of the East River Project. There had been Republican congressional leaders who had been trying to get that changed and to get that process put off for a while until they could better get ready for what it would cause. And it wasn't until yesterday, a week after the election, that Kathy Hochul wrote a letter to Amtrak saying that maybe you shouldn't have done this. And I just wonder what will come of that, too. So stay tuned. But that maybe would have been a way to keep lesser people driving into the city if they could take a train in. My thanks to Anna Markowitz, Judy Patrick, Mark Whitman. You're all wonderful. I appreciate you being here. We'll take a break, right, and be back right after this.